Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're happy to welcome you today to a session that is under the joint auspices of the Sunstone Symposium itself and a fledgling organization about which you may not be too well informed, the Society for the Sociological Study of Mormon Life. That is not an easy name to say. We struggled long and hard when this organization started up some 5 or 6 years ago. We struggled very hard to find a shorter and snappier name for it. But we didn't want it to be a Society for Mormon Sociology because we didn't think there was any such thing as Mormon sociology, or at least we didn't want to purvey it. And yet we wanted our society to be concerned with a study of sociological things about Mormons. So the best we could come up with was the Society for the Sociological Study of Mormon Life. And if you don't like that, you can use our equally clumsy initials, SSML. In the happy event that some of you might give favorable responses to our golden questions, we have membership enrollment forms on the back, small table on the back, just as the you go up the stairs on the way out. And we hope that some of you will consider affiliating yourselves with us for the modest dues of $3 a year. Dues will bring you quarterly newsletters, and other things will help keep you in with a network of people doing sociological work or interested in sociological work on Mormon culture. We have a lot of people who are not sociologists but are in related disciplines, and so you're certainly welcome if you're not a sociologist. In fact, you're welcome if you don't even do any research. We're not, on the whole, really a bunch of professors. We're just all kinds of people with a sociological interest in Mormonism. Well, you'll be pleased to know that that's the end of the commercial. We're happy today to have two papers. This is one of two sessions, by the way, under these joint auspices. And we're happy today to have two papers for you. The first by Rex Cooper, who is a doctoral candidate in anthropology at the University of Chicago. He will present his paper for 15 minutes or so, and then we will have a paper presented by Joseph Olson. Mr. Olson teaches with the BYU program in Salt Lake City, and he is reading the paper today on behalf of its two authors, who are Stan Albrecht and Howard Barr of the Sociology Department at BYU. After each of these presentations has been made, if time permits, which we hope it will, I have prepared a few observations on each of the papers that I will try to present expeditiously, and then there might even be time for some response from the audience. So without cutting into the time anymore, let me now give you Rex Cooper.
I don't know what would be best. I wish I had a joke to tell, but I won't, so I guess I'll just read the paper. Competent observers have been struck by the LDS people's well-developed sense of distinctiveness. Thus, Park and Burgess hold that the Mormon group's self-conception resembles that of a nationality. Martin Marty has suggested that the church has perpetuated an imperial idea among its membership. A. Leland Jameson has written that one may reasonably maintain that no other sizable religious group in this country has so effectively blended religious and secular elements of life into a coherent ethos. And Thomas O'Day concludes that the Mormon people might best be characterized as a quasi-ethnic group with an ecclesiastical organization at its core. In this paper, I would like to suggest ways in which the patriarchal order has contributed to this sense of peculiarity. By patriarchal order, I have in mind the sealing relationships that are affected in Mormon temples, together with the various beliefs and practices that committed Mormons associate with these relationships. I maintain that the patriarchal order is basic to Mormon identity. It provides a practicing Mormon with an integrated structure in terms of which he may simultaneously express his distinctiveness from the rest of mankind and his solidarity with the community of faithful Latter-day Saints. There are only three fundamental relationships within the patriarchal order: husband-wife, father-child, and mother-child. These are ostensibly the same relationships that are basic to American familial organization. Within the context of Mormon ideology, however, these general American relationships are given additional and unique significance. As a result, the manner in which a faithful Mormon regards himself as a husband, a father, or a child is integral to the manner in which he identifies himself as a Mormon. For Mormons, kinship identity becomes almost synonymous with Mormon identity. In order to comprehend the consequence that sealing relationships have for the Mormon sense of peculiarity, it is useful to examine them from five different perspectives. First, mythological underpinnings. Second, the distribution of power. Third, the bases of the relationships. And fourth, the ordering of the relationships. And fifth, the pattern of encompassment. I might have got the numbering mixed up. I didn't have the numbers down on the paper anyway. Time limitations permit me to comment only briefly upon each of these. So I'll begin by talking a bit about mythological underpinnings. I use the term myth here in a way similar to that employed by Bronislaw Malinowski. Malinowski regards as myth any sacred narrative that imbues a social institution or a ritual with cosmic significance by identifying it with events that occurred in a primordial or a otherworldly existence. At least two such myths are associated with the patriarchal order. The first occurred in the far distant past. The second will transpire at some point in the future. General to both of these myths is the assumption that human organization should conform to a divinely established pattern, and that this pattern is based upon the principles of patriarchal organization. As every Mormon Sunday school child should know, the spirits of men were organized according to a divine pattern before they came into mortality. Mormons may differ widely about how specific this organization was. Some will just say that the more noble spirits were foreordained in a general sense to be part of the House of Israel. Others will insist that actual husband-wife and parent-child relationships were established. What seems certain is that the basic pattern was primarily familial in nature. As Brigham Young purportedly declared in 1847, "Our Father in Heaven organized the human family before they came into the world." A similar organization will occur among those who are counted worthy to inherit exaltation in the celestial kingdom. As Parley P. Pratt explains, they will be organized according to their birthright and office in their families, generations, and nations. The gradation will descend in regular degree from the throne of the Ancient of Days down to the last saint of the last days, who may be counted worthy of a throne or scepter, although his kingdom may, perhaps, only consist of a wife and single child. By means of such mythic conceptions, Mormons who have been sealed in the temple believe that they have become part of an organizational structure that was divinely established in the pre-existence and which shall exist eternally in the celestial kingdom. As such, they have become separated from the disorganized and apostate Gentile world. I move now to discussion of the distribution of power. Power in Mormonism is primarily associated with priesthood, a charismatic quality possessed exclusively by properly ordained Mormon males. Within the context of the patriarchal order, there are two centers, or loci, of this power, one theoretical and the other pragmatic. Theoretical power centers in Adam, and the priesthood keys that he monopolizes as the presiding patriarch of the human family. When the patriarchal order is established in its perfection in the celestial kingdom, Mormons believe that this power will pass by patriarchal succession from Adam to his righteous male descendants. By virtue of this delegated patriarchal authority, each will be empowered to govern the wives and children under his jurisdiction. Pragmatic power, on the other hand, centers in the living president of the church and the priesthood keys that he monopolizes as the temporary presiding high priest of the visible Mormon kingdom. It is only by virtue of this power that sealing relationships can be established and dissolved. And it is through the portion of this power that has been delegated to Mormon males that they are regarded by the church as religiously qualified to preside over the wives and children that have been sealed to them. Thus, because priesthood power has two centers, at the same time Mormons are attempting to link themselves with Adam, they are also linking themselves to the authority structure of the church. Bases of relationships. When attempting to identify the components of American kinship, David Schneider postulated that Americans tend to divide their conceptual universe into two general orders, the order of nature and the order of law. The order of nature is how things exist without the intervention of man. The order of law is how things exist as a result of being arranged and regulated by human convention. Kinship combines elements from both orders. Thus, blood relatives share biological substance, an aspect of the order of nature. At the same time, familial relationships are regulated by the state, and kinsmen are supposed to behave towards one another in accordance with prescribed rules of conduct, both aspects of the order of law. Schneider maintains that relationships within American kinship have two fundamental bases. They are grounded both in the order of nature and the order of law. Relationships within the patriarchal order are likewise grounded both in the order of nature and the order of law. Such relationships, however, are believed to manifest characteristics not found in general American kinship. Like American blood relatives, individuals within the patriarchal order are believed to share biological substance. This substance, however, is distinctive and is referred to as the blood of Abraham. By virtue of this blood, Mormons regard themselves as descendants from a common ancestor to whom peculiar genealogically transmittable blessings were given. And this blood is imbued with an ethical quality that makes an individual particularly susceptible to the Mormon gospel. Thus, Mormons regard themselves in an important sense as biologically distinct from their believing, unbelieving Gentile neighbors. Characteristics from the order of law all center upon priesthood power. Not only is it exclusively believed through such power that sealing relationships are established and dissolved, but priesthood officials also prescribe the rules of conduct by which individuals must abide before they can be sealed and to which they must adhere if they hope to have relationships thus established endure throughout eternity. It is probably in this aspect that relationships within the patriarchal order differ most radically from those in general American kinship. Schneider maintains that one of the fundamental aspects of blood relationships is that they are believed to endure despite any eventuality. My mother will thus remain my mother regardless of what she or I might do. The bond between us cannot be terminated. Within the patriarchal order, the situation is different. First, it is believed that only relationships within this order will endure eternally. These relationships, however, will persist only if the parties involved abide by the rules of conduct prescribed by priesthood officials. If I were excommunicated from the church, for example, my mother would still be my mother within the context of American kinship. Within the context of the patriarchal order, however, the sealing relationship between us would be dissolved and could only be restored through action by leading ecclesiastical officials of the church. Ordering of relationships. Two principles define the manner in which sealing relationships are ordered. The first is that of affirmative opposition, and the second is that of hierarchy. By affirmative opposition, I mean that each position is defined in terms of the position to which it is linked through ceiling. Thus, the role of husband is defined in terms of its relationship to wife, and parent in terms of its relationship to child. Hierarchy simply means that in all ceiling relationships, one position is superordinate and the other subordinate. Thus, husband is superordinate to wife and parent to child. There are no ceiling relationships ordered upon the basis of equality. In terms of neither affirmative opposition nor hierarchy, does the patriarchal order differ formally from traditional American familial organization? The employment of these principles within the patriarchal order, however, has distinctive consequences for faithful Latter-day Saints. First, the hierarchical ordering of relationships is regarded as a consequence of the differential delegation of priesthood authority. The husband is thus superordinate to his wife by virtue of the priesthood which not she has received. Parents, in turn, are superordinate to their children by virtue of the patriarchal priesthood which the father possesses and in which the mother participates as a consequence of having been sealed to him as a spouse. Since this priesthood power is regarded as essentially the same as that which regulates the affairs of the church in general, among Mormons, there is ultimately no distinction between domestic and ecclesiastical authority. Second, unlike the situation in general American society, there are no citizens at large within the patriarchal order. There are only husbands and wives, fathers, mothers, and children. Since none of these positions can be occupied without the participant actually being sealed to an individual that holds a position in affirmative opposition to his own, there is considerable incentive for Mormons who want to be ensured of a proper position in the patriarchal family of heaven to establish suitable sealing relationships. The situation is complicated even more by the belief that to be a fully functioning member of the order, an individual must establish at least 4 sealing relationships. In the case of a man, he must be sealed as a child to 2 parents, as a husband to at least 1 wife, and as a father to at least 1 child. For her part, a woman must be sealed as a child to 2 parents, as a wife to a husband, and as a mother to at least 1 child. Considerable anxiety is manifest by devout Mormons who fear that they will leave mortality without having established all the proper sealing links. Three down and one to go, I guess. I mean, I'm married now, but I don't have any children. Encompassment. Relationships within the patriarchal order do not confer ecclesiastical position. And no ecclesiastical position is regarded as a prerequisite for establishing a sealing relationship. It is almost as if the patriarchal order and the church's ecclesiastical organization were 2 separate systems in which essentially the same individuals were related on the basis of different principles. In reality, however, the 2 are part of a single totality. What unites them is the concept of priesthood power. It is thus only by virtue of the priesthood power monopolized by high ecclesiastical officials that sealing relationships are established and regulated. And priesthood ordination ensures the Mormon male both a presiding position within his individual patriarchal family and a position within the church's sacerdotal system. By simultaneously occupying both positions, he becomes the principal link which unites patriarchal order and ecclesiastical organization. Since it is the ecclesiastical organization that establishes the patriarchal order might be said to be encompassed by the church's ecclesiastical system. It is thus an outgrowth of that system and ultimately an appendage to it. A participant within the patriarchal order would regard the establishment of sealing relationships as a way to ensure the eternal perpetuation of family ties. An outside observer, on the other hand, might view sealing, with its associated myth and complex ideology, as a mechanism by which Mormons simultaneously express their distinctiveness from the rest of mankind and more fully place themselves under the jurisdiction of the group's presiding officials. How this occurs is clarified by examining the Mormon social order from the perspective of Edward Shields' concept of center and periphery. Shields holds that cohesion within a society is achieved through its members differentially participating in a common system of social inequality. He speculates that each society is characterized by a distinctive charismatic center. He defines such charisma as that which produces a sense of awe or attraction in the members of the society. Each society's charisma is embodied in its central values, key institutions, and elite personnel. The various members of the society are then ordered on the basis of the degree to which each adopts the society's central values, is involved in its important institutions, and has access to its more powerful members. Thus, the charismatic center of American society is embodied in values associated with wealth, education, and constitutional law and process. The more elite Americans are those who are most, the most elite Americans are those who are most wealthy, most educated, and most politically powerful. The more access the rest of us has to these individuals, or the more wealthy, educated, and politically powerful we personally might be, the more central we are to American society. The more we lack these capabilities, the more peripheral we become. As a matter of course, each of us evaluates every other American he meets on the basis of that individual's proximity to American society's charismatic center. The more close he is perceived to be to that center, the more respect or deference we afford him. Through such evaluation and its associated behavior, cohesion within American society is maintained, or so Shields would say. This model helps us to understand the consequence that the patriarchal order has for American identity and solidarity. Mormon society's charismatic center is the priesthood, an awesome power that is found only within the Mormon Church. This charisma is embodied in the president of the church and his colleagues, the apostles. These elite personnel hold the keys of the priesthood and regulate its administration. Priesthood, in turn, is delegated to the male members of the Mormon community primarily on the basis of the degree to which each exemplifies Mormon values and is loyal to the directions of those under whose priesthood administration he finds himself. The more priesthood authority a man possesses, the more central he is to Mormon society. The less he possesses, the more peripheral he becomes. Differential access to priesthood power is thus a fundamental aspect of Mormon group cohesion. What the patriarchal order does is weld this pattern of cohesion to domestic organization. While each Mormon elder holds priesthood power by virtue of his relationship to the president of the church, he becomes the embodiment of that charisma within the context of his individual family unit. Each of the other members of the unit then gains differential access to that priesthood charisma through the relationship of inequality that the ordinance of sealing has established between that person and the family head. The domestic pattern of cohesion that unites the members of the family thus becomes the basis for linking them to the charismatic center of the Mormon society as a whole. What other differential priesthood power Mormon males might hold within the church's ecclesiastical organization? As patriarchs, they are believed to hold identical authority within their individual family units. As a result, within the context of the patriarchal order, no Mormon family theoretically is more central than another, despite what priesthood positions its male head might hold outside his family unit. Centrality within the patriarchal order as it's presently organized is rather defined in terms of whether or not all proper seating relationships have been established and the degree to which participants are abiding by the rules and regulations associated with seating rituals. Thus, the patriarchal order contributes to a sense of spiritual unity among properly ordered faithful LDS families. Whatever distinctions may exist among them within the context of secular society or the ecclesiastical structure of the church, within the patriarchal order, They were all on an equal footing. The order itself thus provides a mechanism for separating the fully qualified religious community from the rest of mankind and for ordering them according to the divine pattern that was established in the pre-existence and which will exist eternally in the celestial kingdom. By attempting to establish the patriarchal family of heaven, they thus make of themselves a peculiar people.
I did try to prepare some handouts. It's clear that I underestimated how many people would show up to hear sociologists talk. I'd like to... There won't be enough. You'll have to share those. And the copies of the tables that I have are even in shorter supply. Maybe it's best not even to let anybody see them, and then we have equity. I'd like to invite you to send any comments, suggestions, or requests for copies of the entire paper to Stan Albrecht at the Department of Sociology at BYU. Disaffiliation from a religious organization usually follows one of two basic patterns. One, the person disaffiliates because he or she chooses to affiliate with another organization. Or two, the disaffiliate ceases formal religious involvement and becomes a non-member. While the process of religious conversion has received extensive coverage, comparatively little attention has been given to disaffiliation. Either need to be shorter. That doesn't help. Or bend over. Brinkerhoff and Burke, in an article in Sociological Analysis in 1980, argue that by failing to explicate the process of religious disaffiliation, empirical studies and theoretical treatises of church growth and involvement appear to paint a rather incomplete picture. In other words, while studies of religious involvement abound, disinvolvement receives comparatively less attention. And while church growth has been studied extensively, the failure to retain members has attracted only moderate interest. This paper is based on a preliminary analysis of individuals who've decided to become disaffiliated from the Mormon Church, either by dropping out of church participation altogether or by joining another church. As sociologists, we know virtually nothing about individuals who drop out of fast-growing faiths like Mormonism. Kirk Hathaway suggests that stayers and converts in such groups are likely to be more religiously active than those who leave. However, no empirical data have been available that would permit a test of this hypothesis with specific religious groups such as the Mormons. By all counts, the Mormons have a tremendous net advantage when one looks at the phenomenon of religious conversion and switching. In other words, there are far more people who convert to the Mormon Church from other churches or from the status of being disaffiliated from any church than who disaffiliate. In their analysis of national survey data, Wade Roof and Kirk Hathaway again report a 36% net gain for Mormons, a rate that's significantly higher than for any other group in their analysis. However, there are obviously some people whose mobility is outward rather than inward. Our primary purpose in this paper is to provide a preliminary analysis of the characteristics and religious attitudes of such disaffiliates from Mormonism. To put the analysis into the context of the available literature on the topic, we begin with a brief review of the phenomenon of religious switching, denominational switching, and then their existing research on disaffiliation or dropping out as described. The handouts that you have deal with this latter area, disaffiliation, and I'll spend less time on that and deal, given our time, and deal more with denominational switching. The recent work by Roof and Hadaway indicate that denominational switching is relatively common in the United States, as represented by the fact that 40% of American Protestants indicate a denominational preference different from that in which they were raised. Hadaway argues that because many of the Protestant denominations are very similar in doctrine and practice, they essentially serve as alternatives among which one can readily choose. That is, switching denominational affiliation often involves simply changing brands for convenience rather than actively seeking a religious faith that would more adequately express one's personal religious commitment. The absence of any major sanctions against one who changes from one Protestant denomination to another also helps to account for the high levels of interdenominational movement. Even so, Hadaway asserts that switchers are different from stayers in some ways. For example, they're more likely to be religious, perhaps because switching represents a deliberate action or conscious choice on the part of the switcher. For many years, the work of Stark and Glock was a major statement in sociology on patterns of changing religious affiliation. They felt that Protestants who change denominations tend to move from the more theologically conservative to the more liberal denominations. Recently, this has been seriously challenged, and the facts, at least of church growth, do not seem to support it. The liberal and moderate Protestant bodies were losing members and financial support during the last decade, while groups such as Southern Baptists, Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, and various Pentecostal and sectarian groups experienced significant gains in membership and solvency. Roof and Hadaway have emphasized that the direction of the switch is also important. For example, those who switch to high-status liberal Protestant denominations like the Episcopal Church may make the choice as an expression of their upward social mobility, or at least of their desire for upward social mobility. Conservative denominations, on the other hand, are more likely to attract switchers who make the choice for specifically religious as opposed to social status reasons. Evangelical groups are likely to attract persons who seek or have had some special spiritual witness or experience. Again, the religious experience of the individual is critical in understanding his or her change of denominational status. What this means, according to Hadaway, is that the more conservative the denomination, the more likely that denomination is to pick up the better converts. By that, we mean those who make their decisions specifically for religious reasons. This would lead, he argues, to the more frequently supported conclusion that switchers into the conservative organizations are more religiously active than are switchers into the more liberal or moderate organizations. Whatever the denomination, however, the data indicate that switchers are more religiously active than stayers. However, switchers to liberal religious organizations are no more likely to be religiously active than switchers out of these organizations, while switchers into conservative religious organizations tend to be much more active than switchers out. The handout describes some of the perspectives on another phenomenon, which deals with simply dropping out or becoming what Glenn Vernon called the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. Those of you who have that handout can go through the various details on that and read them with your neighbor. I'll proceed ahead in the paper. Although the efforts that are at constructing typologies that are represented on the handout are serve to sensitize us to the important issues that people encounter in disaffiliation, much remains to be learned about the actual processes that are involved. Obviously, we're dealing with very different issues when we compare switchers and dropouts, although some of the motivations may be similar. For example, dissatisfaction with one's current church may lead some people to abandon religion entirely, while it might lead others to actively seek another church affiliation better suited to their needs. Much of the prior work is conceptual in nature, and more empirical analyses are needed to determine the utility of the various typologies. Perhaps more importantly, very little descriptive information is available about people who disaffiliate from the denominations that are growing rapidly, such as the Mormon Church. The analysis that follows is an attempt to extend the empirical base of the available knowledge about religious disaffiliation. The data reported here come from two statewide mail surveys of adult Utahns conducted in 1980 and 1981. The total sample sizes in the range of 2,400. The utility of these data sets for the analysis of religious disaffiliation is that in both, embedded in a series of items on religious preference and activity, was the query, have you ever been a member of a different religious denomination? Spaces were provided for the response to list their former denomination, if any. This former denomination question makes it possible for us to distinguish, for any given religious affiliation, persons who are lifelong members of that group, in contrast to converts and dropouts. Both of the instruments had a two-page section with queries about the respondents' denominational preference, whether they had belonged to other churches, how much time they spent in their church activity, how they worshipped at home, privately, and in their families. The comparison of characteristics of lifelong Mormons, Mormon converts, and former Mormons draws almost entirely on these two pages of items on religious attitudes and experiences. Findings. The Mormon Church has experienced a dramatic and high rate of growth since its inception in 1830. Between 1970 and 1980, the Mormon Church grew by 58%. During 1981, it increased by 335,000 members, including 111,000 children born to Mormon families and 224,000 new converts. So the ratio of converts then to natural increase is about 2-to-1 in the church. Converts from the Mormon Church tend to come from diverse backgrounds, at least in terms of their prior religious affiliation. A total of 140 persons in the surveys listed their current affiliation as Mormon, but said they had previously belonged to a different denomination. A majority of these converts came from the mainline Protestant denominations. Almost 60% gave their prior religious affiliation as Methodist, Lutheran, Presbyterian, or Baptist. 12% had formerly been members of the Catholic Church, and a few had belonged to smaller evangelical and Pentecostal Protestant groups. The denominational distribution of respondents who had left the Mormon Church is markedly different from the distribution of convert origins. 42% of the former members of the Mormon Church could be considered dropouts. That is, they identified no current religious preference. The remaining 58% were switchers to other denominations. Of those who had switched, 38% were members of the Catholic Church. 22%, that means 22% of all of those who defined themselves as former Mormons. I'll summarize. The remainder were scattered among a broad array of Protestant denominations with churches that did not contribute many converts to Mormonism, as likely as the mainline Protestant denominations to be the destinations of former Mormons. This is summarizing. The findings reviewed above suggest the following conclusions. First, the denominations of origin for Mormon converts differ from the denomination of destination of former Mormons. The converts in Utah come largely from the mainline Protestant churches, whereas the largest single group of disaffiliates are dropouts, in the sense that they no longer consider themselves Mormons but do not identify with another denominational preference. The next most frequent sample is a Catholic. The next most frequent religious preference of disaffiliates from Mormonism in our Utah sample is the Catholic faith. In fact, the dropouts and the converts to Catholicism make up over 60% of the former Mormons. The remainder typically affiliate with one of the mainline Protestant religions. Secondly, the ranking of Mormon converts, lifelong Mormons, and former Mormons, and this is some that we didn't go through in detail, was as Albrecht and Chet and Bard expected, with the converts to Mormonism having the highest religiosity scores and the former Mormons the lowest. When former Mormons as a group, including the switchers and the dropouts, were contrasted with other Utahns, it appears that their religiosity levels were lower than those of Protestants and Catholics. But higher than those than the respondents who have no church preference. However, when the switchers and dropouts from Mormonism were compared separately to the other categories of respondents, we find that dropouts from Mormonism resemble other no-preference respondents, while the switchers resemble those in the faiths in which they have joined. Finally, the relative size of the switchers and dropout populations among former Mormons is of interest. Former Mormons are significantly more likely to be dropouts who claim no religious preference than are those who leave other denominations. Among all respondents combined in the surveys who gave an answer other than Mormon to the item, "Have you ever been a member of a different religion or denomination?" only 14% identified no preference as their current religious preference. Among the 59 former Mormons, the corresponding percentage was 42%. Thus, at least among residents of Utah, former Mormons are almost as apt to claim no religious preference as to join another faith. In marked contrast to former members of other religions in the state, where only one-seventh of whom presently claim no religious preference. Why might this be? Why do former Mormons exhibit greater propensity to abandon all religion than do switchers from other faiths? Two explanations come to mind. First, in a state where three-fourths of the population are members of the Mormon Church, there may be less stigma attached to quiet withdrawal from affiliation with Mormonism than to the acceptance of a visible and statistically deviant affiliation with a minority denomination. To join another denomination is to publicly reveal one's apostasy from Mormonism, while to withdraw from Mormonism and avoid other denominational entanglements leaves one in an ambiguous and hence less deviant status. The second possible explanation is related to the theological positions of the Mormon Church with respect to the authority and teachings of other Christian denominations. Even though the former Mormon may reject Mormonism as his or her religion of choice, the official position that other modern Christian churches are only partly true and that they lack divine authority creates a mental climate in which the rejection of Mormonism as a lifestyle or a theological system does not necessarily push the dropout any closer to a Protestant or Catholic denomination. In other words, the acceptance of Mormon theology typically includes a commitment to the inadequacies of the modern denominations of Christianity. Rejection of Mormon theology or lifestyle does not necessarily change the attitudes toward the legitimacy of these other denominations, and hence a neutral, non-denominational position may be more compatible with the values of a former Mormon than would affiliating with another denomination. Thank you.
Really, very few minutes remain for any commentary I might make. I'll make just a few comments, a couple of minutes each, on the papers in the reverse of the order in which they were given. I think both of the papers raise a lot of interesting questions, and as the beginning of research lines or directions, I think they're both very valuable. We will, of course, want to get data about that second paper from outside Utah, because we can all think of a whole lot of different ways in which the Utah situation is not typical. We will want to have all kinds of qualitative analyses of the defectors for Mormonism. Who are they? Why? What are their various reasons for defecting? The gross quantitative data of the kind we've heard are not able to answer those questions. What part does differential social class play in their defection? It's been observed already that there's a tendency to switch to higher status Protestant religions. In Mormonism in particular, I sense there is an upward mobility ethic that may have some casualties. If you make it, fine. What about the ones that are left behind? I have some evidence that the ones who are left behind in this upward mobility ethic in Mormonism are the ones most likely to go to Jehovah's Witnesses, born-again evangelical Christians, and the like. So there is a question there. What is the process or the stages, if there are any, through which people go in the process of defection? Is closet doubter a phenomenon that is that a way station on the way out, or is it a way of staying in? You know, which is it? these kinds of qualitative questions about defectors and potential defectors, I think, are interesting to ask. There's one strong recommendation I would make about the manipulation of the data, if Joe can carry the message back, and that is that before conclusions are drawn about the relative importance of the different new affiliations that former Mormons make, some correction has to be made in the data for the numerical size of those other denominations. The fact that most people who join something else join the Catholic Church may be a function of the relative numerical superiority of Catholics in Utah. In other words, there are both, as a person leaves the church, there will be push factors maybe pushing him out, but there are pull factors too. And we know a lot about the importance of social networks in the conversion process, whether the conversion is to Mormonism or to Catholicism or to something else. So the more likely a disaffected Mormon is to run into Catholic friends, the more likely he is to join the Catholic Church. So we would have to make corrections for that. And I suspect that when some corrections are made for the relatively small sizes of these highly conservative born-again evangelical groups, they will turn out to have disproportionately strong pulling power in getting former Mormons. In other words, I think the Tanners are making more inroads and the Deckers than a lot of people would like to admit. On the first paper, I would again observe that I think Rex has done a really fine job as an anthropologist in articulating the official ideology of the Mormon patriarchal system. And like good theoretical papers of all kinds, it raises a lot of empirical questions, not the least of which is the question of whether all of this ideology makes any difference at all in behavior or in actual practice. We have some data that bear upon this question, and on the whole, they are not encouraging data from the point of view of someone who wants to hope that the patriarchal order is alive and well in the lives of the saints. And Rex more than once mentioned that there are lots of ways in which the ideal Mormon family is like the ideal American family. There are also lots of ways in which the actual Mormon family is like actual American families. When we look at such data as we have on divorce rates, on parent-child relationships and difficulties therewith, again, the findings do not bespeak, I think, a terribly distinctive Mormon family life in actual practice. Now, of course, it's important, as always, to distinguish between the temple-married and the non-temple married. So that's a distinction that has to be made. But I find myself a little impatient with those who, having made that distinction, then go on to pretend like the non-temple married part doesn't exist, as though they're not Mormons too. There's a tendency to kind of explain away the failures of living the faith by simply saying, well, we all know they're inactive. And once we know that, that sort of explains everything. Well, of course it doesn't. But I think we need to do some really good empirical research into such questions as differential divorce rates, and there is some research that's already been done on that in church headquarters, and we're going to be hearing more about it. On the real differences between temple and non-temple married people, and of those who, for having been married in the temple or for any other reason, tough it out and don't get divorced, why are they staying together? What is the quality of the married life going on in these marriages? Do they stay together because they feel the heavy hand of church sanction, or do they stay together because the temple marriages really are more gratifying expressions of a unique patriarchal ideal? So we need to find out why the people who stay together, as well as finding out why those who don't stay together don't. And in particular, there's really, really convincing evidence now, I think, that where this is really good news, I think, from the point of view of modern Latter-day Saints anyway. The news is that where husband-wife relationships are concerned, it's mostly patriarchal talk and egalitarian behavior. And I think so. Again, you know, we got the question of what difference does all of this patriarchal ideology make in actual behavior? We don't have all of the answers to that. We need to ask also whether there are some unintentional dysfunctions in that that spring from that ideology. People who maybe people who perhaps misunderstanding or misapplying the patriarchal ideology to mean, for example, that you should get married as fast as possible after the onset of puberty, which seems to be a common Mormon practice that I have heard many people connect with this patriarchal ideology. I don't find it inherent in the patriarchal ideology. Or the fact that you have to have a baby every year no matter what. I don't find that is inherent in the patriarchal ideology, but I find a lot of people articulating a rationale for that as though it is. Not long ago in Dialogue, Harold Christensen had a very interesting article on the sources of strain in Mormon family life. And in this article to which I would refer you, he articulates a great many of what might be called potential dysfunctions of a patriarchal ideology, ways in which the ideology works itself out in actual behavior or in the perceptions that people have about the way it's supposed to be, rather than finding, as we would like to, I think, in the church, a behavior that exemplifies the higher ideals of that patriarchal system. And I'm sure Rex is as interested in, as any of the rest of us in finding out some empirical answers to questions that deal with the connections, if any, between actual behavior and ideology. With that, we will have to dismiss you. I remind you again of enrollment forms for SSSML on the table in the back. Thank you.